The first case on the oral argument calendar for the Southern panel, consisting of myself, Justice Pickering, and Justice Douglas, is Elia San Juan et al. Versus PSC Industrial Outsourcing, Inc. et al., case number 50033. Mr. Sire, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Federico Castellan Sayer. I'm one of the attorneys representing the appellants and plaintiffs below. At the heart of our case is Restatement Section 416 and 427, which impose mandatory duties on the employer of contractors when there is a risk under 416 of physical harm, which the employer should recognize as likely to arise to others in the course of the ordinary course of doing the work, and 427, there is a risk inherent in the work itself to others. In addition, we rely upon Peck versus Womack, which is this court's decision in 1948, but still is good law and has not been overturned, on the issue of negligence, whereas 416 and 427 are on the issue of strict liability. Now, the court below utilized the case of Sierra Pacific versus Reinhardt to exclude the employees of DTI from the definition of others. And respectfully, I believe that that was misapplied, and I'd like to explain to the court why I believe so. Sierra Pacific incorporated fully the balancing test under Nelson versus the United States. The balancing test basically looks at certain factors. Factor number one is whether or not the contractor was competent or not. Factor number one is whether they were knowledgeable of the dangers involved. Factor number two is whether they were competent or not. Factor number three is whether they're solvent. Now, Mr. Gonzalez has testified, as we've explained in our brief, that he felt there was no danger of explosion, but both the expert Knuth, who was hired by the plaintiffs, and the expert Fox, who was hired by the defendants, said that this was a very dangerous operation, and there was an extreme danger of explosion. Whenever you mix air with propane and isobutane, which occurred even when you use the machine. Secondly, as far as incompetence is concerned, same issue, a mixture of air with propane and isobutane. There was poor ventilation. The operation was performed in a closed box. There was no safety equipment, no training, and the use of an electric forklift, which supplied, we believe, the spark that set forth this explosion.
Isn't question from a policy standpoint, as that second point you're raising, there's assertions that the party who was actually doing the work had misrepresented to PSC how they conducted their business.
Yes, that is an argument that was made by my opponent, and that issue that they didn't know. However, that's not part of 416 and 427. 416 and 427 impose liability for injuries resulting from dangers that the employer should contemplate at the time he enters into the contract. He cannot share responsibility for such dangers or take precautions against the contract.
In this particular case, he went out, he physically, if I understand correct, inspected the plant, inspected the process, and then the reality was they used a totally different process in what was represented.
Well, but they asked about the Connex box, and they asked what it was about. They were given the opportunity to inspect the Connex box, but never entered it to find out what was going on. They sent 28,000 to 72,000 cans per week, which couldn't possibly be handled by the machine that handled one can at a time, that should have put them on notice that there was some other procedure going on.
And wasn't there some other testimony to the fact that when customers came, they would always not show them how they actually did it?
Well, that's true, but they also, when they came for the inspection, they could have gone into the Connex box. They were shown it. They were not prevented from doing so, and they had the opportunity to do so. And I have to reiterate, there were too many cans being sent to be accommodated by just this one machine that did one can at a time. Mr. Knuth said that if someone is supplying such as PSC with this amount of cans to DTI, they should be aware that decanting would be a dangerous process, and they should be interested in whether the process was being done safely or not.
The trial judge seemed to make a finding that there was an issue as to the mixture of cans, that the cans were not purely from one source.
The cans were from different sources. In fact, there was an issue raised for the first time on appeal on the issue of causation. It was never decided on causation by the district court. However, although that's improper, I do have evidence to support the causation issue on two points. One is that shortly after the explosion and fire, the tragedy that occurred, PSC came out without their normal process of getting an advance payment and completely cleaned up everything, took the cans, took them someplace, destroyed them, and they didn't inventory them. They didn't in any way identify what they took. Under the usual spoliation of evidence principles, that fact should be weighed against them, that it should be basically weighed that this would be contrary to them if it were to be tried.
And secondly, you did not raise that argument in the district court respecting spoliation. You say because your opponents didn't assert it causation as a basis for summary judgment.
That is correct, Your Honor. All they argued was duty. They did not argue causation.
And how did the trial judge make this, from your standpoint, errant finding as to the mixture of cans? Where did that come from?
Well, I don't know exactly, but I can give you second testimony, which is Kevin Carnahan testified. He was from PSC. He testified that the customers of PSC made no direct shipments of household products, including hair products like Bedhead, because he knew, because he managed the product shipments. So there was direct testimony that the shipments could only have been made by PSC and not by the customers of PSC, since those were the only two sources of cans that were shipped. But that was evidence that was down below. But there was no decision by the Court of Appeals, by the District Court on the issue of causation.
Certainly its order gets into it, though. It's summary judgment order.
Yes. It does reflect that, but there is evidence that would I believe, should go to the trier of fact as to whether or not this shipment of this Bedhead cans, which was identified by Captain Terry Taylor, whether this came from PSC or whether it came from the customers of PSC. And the evidence is from Mr. Carnahan that it came from PSC.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Counsel, in response to Justice Douglas's question about whether this information or the process used was actually disclosed and made aware, you responded by referring the panel to Section 416 and 427 of the restatement. But in your presentation, you were arguing error under Sierra Pacific.
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
You were arguing error under Sierra Pacific.
Yes. Yeah. Sierra Pacific was...
If I may finish the question.
Of course you can.
You've conflated the two. The question I have is why should this court accept or adopt 416 and 427 of the restatement for purposes of liability in these cases?
And if it does,
is there an exception in circumstances in which the independent contractor, has deceived the employer with respect to the process that's being used?
Sierra Pacific and Nelson don't talk specifically about the issue of deceiving the contractor. However, they do talk about whether or not the employer of the contractor is in a position to be the person that is best able to, this is under the balancing test of Nelson, to be best able to prevent the accident because of their superior knowledge to the contractor. And that's what we believe the evidence shows. Our opponents have never argued that the contractor was knowledgeable or competent or not insolvent. The PSC is a nationwide company that basically handles this type of hazardous waste on a regular basis. They have the ability to determine what could and should be done. The Douglas County requirements that an operation like this that involves workers who handle flammable gases, there must be less than 25% of the lower explosive limit, that's something that they could and should be fully knowledgeable about with regard to this issue, and they are in a better position to prevent the injury from occurring. Now, as to an exception for for misleading them, I guess it becomes an issue of fact as to the extent that this really misled them versus what they actually did.
What you're urging the panel to consider, and the reason we have this case on for oral argument in part, is whether the court should consider a non-delegable duty in circumstances such as this. My question is where you have a company who goes out, looks at the process, is satisfied with the procedures that they are shown and are disclosed to them, and then there is an explosion that occurs in some rogue operation in the backyard, and I don't mean to exaggerate this, but I'm trying to make a point in referencing it in that way. Why would that non-delegable duty extend to that kind of circumstance?
Because
why should we impose liability when the contractor does something completely different than what has been disclosed and what has been understood by the employer?
Because the issue is whether they knew or should have known that this was the only process that was going on and whether they did an adequate job and a reasonable job of inspecting. And that's an issue of fact which should be decided by the trier of fact rather than on summary judgment motion.
Well, if there's a non-delegable duty, there's no question of fact about the duty, is there?
There's no question of fact about the duty, but there's a question of fact as to whether or not there was an adequate audit done when they went out to take a look at this facility and whether or not they were actually misled by what was stated or falsely stated by the contractor, whether they knew or should have known to look further and to look beyond that misrepresentation. And I believe that that is the issue. I would like to, unless the court has other questions, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes or so for my...
Just as that last point, just noting in Judge Gibbons' order, on page 6, he indicates that Mr. San Juan and Mr. Gonzalez both made statements in their depositions that the barrels evidencing the manual decanting process had to be hidden whenever customers visited the plant, and that was Mr. San Juan. And then Mr. Gonzalez testified the deposition that workers were instructed to put away all evidence of manual decanting process when customers visited.
Yes, but I still believe that the issue is one of whether there was reasonable behavior on the part of PSC in doing their audit under the circumstances in which the Connex box was available to them to look inside it, and on the basis that they shipped so many cans, there's no way that they could have been handled by this one machine, one can at a time.
I want to explore this question again with you because we may not be communicating.
All right, sir.
The district court said on page 7 of its order, and I think this is, to me at least, this is a critical part of its order. Plaintiffs argue that PSC owed them a non-delegable duty under the Restatement of Torts 413, 16, and 27. Generally, a person who hires an independent contractor is not liable to third parties for injuries caused by the contractor's negligence. And then it says, this is not without exception. One exception is that a person who hires an independent contractor to perform work that is inherently dangerous can be held liable for damages when the contractor's negligent performance of the work causes injuries to others, citing Peck. That's the position you advocate.
Yes, that's correct. Are there any other questions?
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
Mr. Dodson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rob Dodson. Along with Eileen Rockovitz, I represent Phillips Services Corporation and PSC Outsourcing and what's generally referred to as the PSC-related companies. This case comes to you on cross motions for summary judgment, and that's important. And the reason it's important is our motion for summary judgment on behalf of PSC was as to all claims. But after that had been filed, and by the way, that was a renewed motion. We'd filed that motion at the commencement of this case. We waited till discovery was concluded, and we filed it again, and it was granted very close to the trial date.
There was a 56F motion on the original, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. And after that, after we had filed our motion, a cross motion on the very narrow issue that is before you, the peculiar risk doctrine, was filed. I would submit to this court on behalf of my client that that is a concession, that there are no remaining factual issues to be tried by the trier of fact, to be examined by the trier of fact, at least as to that narrow issue. With regard to this case, The court below found that no rational trier of fact could return a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs. And we would submit to you, this is precisely the Gossamer Threads of Whimsy type argument that this court has determined is appropriate for summary judgment. In essence, our case is, it's not our stuff, it was not our employees, and it was not our property. And I want to examine each of those issues. First of all, with regard to the issue of it not being our stuff, this is the causation or damages issue. It is a cornerstone of our jurisprudence that if you're going to be held liable for someone's injury because some act you did, you have to have some relationship to that.
Whether did you raise that in your motion for summary judgment?
I did, and I'm going to give you a particular cite. Okay. It was raised first in our motion for summary judgment, which is at the on the record on appeal at 772. It was then raised again in almost, I'm embarrassed to say, very similar language, almost identical as what appears in our brief, in our reply, which is found on the record on appeal at 1015 and 1016. This language is almost verbatim what is in the appeal. So I take issue with the representation of appellants that it was never raised. But I would embrace Justice Pickering, that you have raised, that they, by not raising the spoliation issue below, have waived it. I can discuss that further, but I don't want to use my precious time for that unless it's a question by the court. Now, with regard to the it's not our stuff, there simply is no evidence. It's not a matter of just us bringing forth evidence that is unrebutted, but they have brought forth no evidence that it is our material. In essence, what the testimony is that there's an implication here today that PSC was the only customer. PSC is not the only customer for DTI. The facts, I would concede, seem to imply that we were by far the largest customer, but not the only customer. What Mr. Carnahan's testimony is appropriate for is that most of these are consumables that have been recycled mostly by municipalities in California. Basically, they would have these recycling events. People would bring in their aerosol cans that need to be decanted. They would be sent either because PSC elected to send them to DTI or sometimes because the municipality did. I think one of the examples was Cupertino. It had been marketed to them that this process, which was originally occurring in California, was a good process, and most of the material was recyclable, so they specifically asked it to come. In contrast, the only evidence as to the items that were actually being decanted at the time of this accident is that they were from a company called Tigi Lanai. And again, in our motion for summary judgment, we cite to the fact that the plaintiffs had tried to add that as that entity as a party, which again we would suggest is a concession and recognition that they knew they didn't have the right customer here. And that's what my client is, by the way. My client is a customer. I want to now go to the issue of 416 and 427. And this is basically a means to impose vicarious liability upon someone who might hire an independent contractor. And this is where the fact that they are not our employees and it's not our property is very significant. And with the time that Mr. Sayer has remaining, one of the issues that I would ask him to address with this court is whether there is any case, and I can't represent to the court that there's not because I haven't completed the exhaustive research that I would have liked to have, but is there any case where 416 and 427 have been applied when the customer, the employer or owner, is not the owner of the premises or has control of the premises where the event occurred? For example, in the Nelson case, although I guess the United States probably did own the land that the breakwater was built upon, it's not private property. But in most of the cases and in most of the examples in the restatement, and also the court might look at 413, which is also a similar restatement section, the examples are a property owner who is very familiar with the area and the circumstance and might have greater knowledge. Now, in this case, you actually...
The problem is the black letter in the restatement is worded more broadly than that. Unless you define others to exclude the independent contractor's employees, you don't get to the rule you're articulating. And they're relying on Peck versus instead of the Sierra Pacific case and saying, well, Sierra Pacific has these exceptions that apply, and that is incompetent insolvent, and I forget the third one, employer.
Knowledge. Knowledge is kind of the first issue.
So they go to that point and say those are real limitations and create genuine issues of material fact based on the Con Ed box and the number of canisters or cans that are being shipped, and that the automated one could not handle that. What do you do with that argument? Are you saying that Sierra Pacific actually means when that it's a black letter rule that other can never be the independent contractor's employees?
I actually believe it is a black letter rule, and that's exactly where I was going, Your Honor, was that in this, we're not talking a whole lot about Reinhardt and Sierra Pacific, but in this state, in 1983, the decision was made that others, and I'll just read 416, for example, one who employs the independent contractor to do work which the employer should recognize as likely to create during its progress a peculiar risk of physical harm to others unless special precautions are taken. And it's that definition of others. And that same term is in 413 and in 427 that is, I guess, the issue at the crux of the appellant's argument. And in the Sierra Pacific, this court determined that others cannot include the employees of the subcontractor. That was also the decision in Nelson, and it was also the decision in California in 1993 in Prevett when they overruled the longstanding broader and minority position, even at that time, but now even far more minority, that others should include the employee.
So even if the independent contractor's employee was fully insolvent and completely incompetent, you would say that 416 and 427 would never apply in favor of that employee's employees?
I would say that, and I would say there's public policy reasons for that, but if you look at the facts of this particular case, which I hope to do.
You don't need to go that far.
You don't even have to go that far. But let's talk about those general rules, because after all, the decision that is rendered from this court is going to be the law, at least in the state of Nevada, and it's going to be broadly applied. And that's why it's important that this court be careful and consider the far-reaching effects that I think the position advocated by the appellants would result in. The Nelson court used some very interesting language. They say it would result in perverse and fortuitous results. Let me use an example. Let's say that these employees, and the point is that an employee, if you adopt this definition of others, an employee is actually better off if they are injured while completing a task for an owner/customer than the employee would be if they're just strictly completing a virtually identical task just for their employer. That's at Nelson at 475, that essential quote in discussion. Let's use this example. These are aerosol cans. Let's say that the appellants here are employees in an aerosol can company, and there is a horrible and tragic accident. And by the way, there's no doubt that this was a horrible and tragic accident. And they are massively burnt. They will recover, just as they did in this case, from workers' compensation. However, if you adopt the position advanced by appellants here, and they're decanting that same can, they recover not only from workers' compensation from their employer, but also they have the opportunity to recover and likely will recover, because this is essentially going to, as Justice Hardesty stated, create a duty and is essentially results in strict liability. They're going to recover a greater sum even from the customer that is hired, that has happened to bring this product to beat it. And as the Nelson court says, there's a contrary logic to that. And what it advances is a public policy that you don't want to advance. And that is that people will not want to hire independent contractors because their exposure will be less by having it done by their own employees. In fact, it would be better for that person to hire a less competent employee to complete that task than a more competent and more expert and more efficient subcontractor or independent contractor. Now, there was some examination earlier by Justice Douglas regarding the issue of knowledge, and that is the principal and first issue that is addressed in Nelson. And in this case, knowledge is very, very important because the knowledge here, and I'm proud of what my client did. They actually went out and audited it. I would draw the analogy to and it happens to be true in this instance, I've got a truck that my gas gauge isn't working. Well, they tell me to fix it. They've got to take the gas tank out of my truck. So what am I to do? Should I go to the shop and audit how that's going to happen? Or should I just trust that they know what they're doing? I drop off my car, I leave, and I come back. Let's think about that example that I just gave. All right, they're going to take out my gas tank. It should be obvious to me that there's going to be gasoline in there. What if some poor soul uses a torch to remove that gas tank? What if they are horribly burnt? Under the position advanced by the appellants here, I am now responsible. He gets to recover from the auto dealer not only for his workers' compensation, but also against me because of this peculiar risk of removing my gas tank. But in this case, I would take what they're suggesting here is even farther. It's not my car. It's the guy's next to me. And the guy who's working on my car gets burnt too. And so he sues me because the guy next to me brings in a car with a bad gas tank. I mean, that's how perverse the result can be if you adopt the position advanced by appellants. Here, it is undisputed by the appellants themselves that they hid this process, that they conducted it covertly at night and behind locked doors. It is ironic and truly sad that this facility was inspected by NDEP just days before this accident, and they, too, failed to discover this process. I would submit to you, and it's speculative, but I can't imagine any of the customers, my client or any of the other ones, approving of this process. We simply did not have the knowledge, and this is where the property issue becomes important. The accident did not occur on PSC's property. Therefore, they had no special knowledge of what was going on. They had no ability to supervise it, such as in the Nelson case, when the Coast Guard actually had someone there on wave watch. I mean, there was no allegation there that they're doing anything odd or wrong, such as decanting cans or, say, he was repairing the breakwater in a child's inflatable toy, which would be an analogous circumstance here, I would submit. But the point is, we don't have that opportunity because we're customers bringing a product for processing. DTI appeared competent. Now, this action doesn't make it look so much so, but they appeared competent. They were licensed by California previously. They were licensed by Nevada now. They had been in business a significant time with PSE and other entities. And they had designed and marketed this proprietary reverse-engineered aerosol machine, which everybody admitted looked pretty darn good. Do I have to test the methodology to remove my gas tank from my car?
Well, but their point is, I think, that they presented enough for there to be an inference that the separate, almost like an alter ego type of claim, that PSC and DTI were so intertwined and DTI was essentially in a sort of a parasitic relationship with PSC, that really PSC was just operating almost as a sham through DTI. I know I'm overstating their case,
but that's
the case they're trying to make.
And
if you had that case, would you concede that there could be liability?
If you have solid, admissible evidence, then that's perhaps a different case. But we are so far from that, Your Honor. I mean, one of the examples I make in the, and I have 30 seconds, I'll be very brief. One of the examples I make in our argument is that even if they were married to each other, and there is no relation, we haven't even identified who the supposed executive is, that still can't create this circumstance. And if it does, if that's your law, then we've got to be careful what our spouses do. We've got to be careful what our friends do. We've got to be careful what we do business with. Lastly, if I can address the solvency issue for one last thing, that the court below made it very clear that these folks did recover under workers' compensation. Nelson was an admiralty case, involved the Jones Act. Therefore, the solvency of the, if I can complete my response.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it's been a long time since I took admiralty, 1993 or so. But under the Jones Act, it's important whether they're solvent because you've got to be able to have an independent action against the employer. Here, the issue is going to be workers' compensation. And in Nevada, PSC and other employers have made the decision to allow or to pay into the system, and then that system paid, the court found, almost $800,000 in benefits at that time towards these appellants.
May I ask one question?
Mm-hmm.
So your point would be that solvency is not a criteria at all, even arguably, because it only under
Jones Act cases.
Yeah.
Or similar circumstances.
Or Nelson. Under Nelson, it was a Jones Act and just got carried forward into Sierra Pacific.
Right. And I would suggest that we're in the desert and maybe the admiralty law and the specifics of the Jones Act, although it applies up in Nevada or up at Tahoe, might not have been appreciated by the court at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Dotson. Mr. Sire.
There would be no reason to read the Nelson Balancing Act test into Sierra Pacific if there weren't exceptions available under the three issues of knowledge, competency, and solvency. We wouldn't be here today if DTI had afforded workmen's compensation coverage. That would have precluded any lawsuit against them or any lawsuit against PSC, but they didn't. And so the people of the state of Nevada have to pay for it. But if we succeed against PSC, then the lien would come back to the people of the state of Nevada where it should rightfully come. This is the public policy issue here, and that is, if there is a balancing test, and there is, then we are in an issue of fact, which should respectfully be decided by the trier of fact and not on summary judgment. And that goes to issues such as whether there was a reasonable and appropriate audit that was done by PSC, whether PSC had a special relationship with DTI, which should be viewed by the trier of fact to determine whether or not that was so parasitical that basically they were in control of DTI. And those are the issues which I believe should be decided by the trier of fact.
Well, I think there might be one issue, one additional issue here. In looking at the judge's order, it's pretty clear that the judge resolved both the original motion for summary judgment and your partial motion for summary judgment. What do you say in response to counsel's argument that, A, their original motion raised causation, and B, you didn't address it?
Well, causation, I don't believe it. However it was addressed, it's never addressed under the heading or the topic of causation by counsel, not in any of his pleadings or in any of his briefs. As to my partial summary judgment motion, I believe that that is appropriate, but that doesn't preclude any of the issues which I've raised. I basically brought a partial summary judgment motion on the
What did you say? He maintains in the motion for summary judgment originally filed,
yes,
that he invoked all issues associated with liability.
Well, he didn't raise the issue of causation. He argued the issue of duty, and our partial summary judgment just went to the issue of duty.
Okay. All right, thank you. Anything further? I interrupt.
No, nothing further. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your arguments and briefs here. The matter will stand submitted. We thank you for your arguments, and we'll